Good morning and welcome to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke, the producer of the Roundtable on WAMC. Each weekday morning, WAMC's president, CEO, and political observer Alan Shartok and Roundtable host Joe Donahue were joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable panel, The Week in Review, we feature your favorite panelists discussing the most important issues of the week. On Monday, April 12th, Joe and Alan were joined by immigration attorney and partner with the Albany law firm of Whiteman, Osterman & Hanna, Sienna Freeman Tolbert, political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post, and Albany Law School professor and director of the Immigration Law Clinic, Sarah Rogerson.
Minnesota officer shoots black driver and protesters clash with police. So that is another very disturbing story that's coming out of a place that is 10 miles away from where the Derek Chauvin case will continue. I believe it's third week today. A young man pulled over for a traffic violation, died after being shot near Minneapolis, where Derek is on trial over the killing and over the death of George Floyd. A 20-year-old black man died. It was during a traffic stop on Sunday, sending hundreds of people into the streets where they clashed with police officers well into the early hours of this morning. The protest in Brooklyn Center came hours before the 11th day of the trial of Derek Chauvin, the former Minneapolis police officer who's been charged with the murdering of George Floyd, and that is set to begin in a courtroom less than 10 miles away. Outside of the Brooklyn Center Police Department on Sunday, smoke billowed into the air as a line of police officers fired rubber bullets and chemical agents as protesters, some of whom lobbed rocks, bags of garbage, and water bottles at the police. Brooklyn Center's mayor ordered a curfew until 6 a.m., and the local school superintendent said the district would move to remote learning on Monday out of an abundance of caution. A woman who said she was the victim's mother identified him as Daunte Wright, 20 years old. It, of course, injected more frustration and anxiety into the Twin Cities, where Mr. Floyd's death and the destructive protests that followed are fresh in the residents' mind. We're not exactly sure what happened. Here are the details as we know right now. Chief Tim Gannon of the Brooklyn Center Police Department said an officer had shot the man on Sunday afternoon after pulling his car over for a traffic violation and discovering that the driver had a warrant out for his arrest. As the police tried to detain the man, he stepped back into his car, at which point an officer shot him. The man's car then traveled for several blocks and struck another vehicle, after which the police and medical workers pronounced him dead. Chief Gannon did not give any information on the officer who fired or say how severe the crash had been, though the passengers in the other car were not injured. The chief said he believed that officers' body cameras had been turned on during the shooting. So, Alan, I hate to start off this way, but, you know, here we go again.
Well, I couldn't agree more. Here we go again. I am so unhappy about what we are seeing in this country. And I am so unhappy about what police think their role has to be. We had the army officer, Joe, I'm sure you've seen the clips from that one.
Yeah. Yep.
In Virginia, who really was putting up with a terrible confrontation with a jerky officer. And look, we know that police are important, but they're not omnipotent. And when they pull this kind of stuff, all they're doing is digging their own professional graves, because people are just not ready to have this anymore. So I guess that's where I am this morning.
Sienna, what do you make of the situation?
Well, like you said earlier, we don't know many details about what happened in Minnesota, even though we know it's tragic and it's hard to see again. Quite frankly, you know, it's as an African-American, it's really hard to watch. And so I tend to turn away, unfortunately, from a lot of these stories because it's a little overwhelming to deal with. The story I was dealing with was the story that was out of Virginia that Alan spoke of. I was just looking into that one a little bit more because, you know, at least there was no violence on the video. I've been watching what happened in that interaction. And I got to say, it's very disheartening after everything that went on with George Floyd. that we're still dealing with it at this level, that is still coming forth like so quickly. We're seeing these events happen. We thought that hopefully after what happened last year in March, that police organizations were going back in-house, right, and rethinking the way their officers interact with the community. That's what we all would like to think about what happened after last March, is that that's what was happening, is they're rethinking how they interact. And what we're seeing is that that's not happening. If anything, it seems like the tenor has gone up a little bit more, and that the, you know, that is a little more confrontational, as we saw in the Virginia video. And so that's concerning to myself. I know it's concerning to other people in the community about how are we really going to reach law enforcement. Because there was this big backlash about defund the police. Huge. That's a terrible thing to say, you know. But now, as we're just trying to figure out, well, we don't want to defund you. How do we get you to rethink how you approach policing? And I think that's the frustrating conversation that we need to have.
Absolutely.
And it's very frustrating as people of color of the communities, like figuring out how do we get an actual change.
Sarah Rogerson.
How do we get actual change? And it's not happening in the Minnesota legislature. You know, they passed some bipartisan reforms last year. The legislature approved a bill restricting chokeholds, changing the training so that it's less militaristic, and requiring other officers to intervene when an officer is using excessive force. But what it didn't do, and what the bigger push is now nationally, I think, because we're seeing it as maybe the only thing that will work at this point where policing has been infiltrated by white supremacist groups and others, right? It's a systemic issue. There are lots of good people in the system trying to reform it from the inside, but there's still a healthy problem, an unhealthy problem, a sickness that remains. And we're really talking about qualified immunity and the shields that officers have that don't only shield good actors, right, that don't need it, but that more importantly shield bad actors from facing personal consequences because they can hide behind the official title, the government action that they purport to engage in when they're doing their job. The problem is when they don't do it correctly, when they violate the Constitution, the state and federal Constitution, when they're doing their job, they should be held accountable. And so there are pushes now to really get at qualified immunity and poke holes in qualified immunity to make sure that we're not shielding officially this type of you know, anti-constitutional behavior in the police force, because there are leaders in police reform and in police departments who are frustrated about the tools or the lack of tools in order to hold their own ranks accountable because of the way that the system is structured, right? And so we've got a lot of work to do, obviously. I'm glad that we're hearing more about these things and that there's a more diverse coalition of people interested in tackling them than there has been in the past. But obviously, it's a huge, huge problem, and any reforms that have been made have not gone far enough.
You know, now, Sarah, I think there are people who are listening right now who are not as familiar as you and I may be with what qualified immunity means. You've mentioned it a couple of times. Could you just spend a couple of seconds on that?
Yeah, and I was trying to find the words that aren't qualified immunity. But basically, if an officer is acting in his or her official capacity, there are certain laws in place that shield that individual from being held personally responsible if they were acting in accordance with their governmental duty. Being part of what the push is to draw some finer lines around that. Like maybe you're acting in your official capacity, but you went outside the bounds of your own laws and procedures, right? For example, you engaged in a chokehold when those have been banned by the legislature, or you have used excessive force when it wasn't warranted. you should be not just, suspended and then have the department have to implement reforms or you have to go to a sensitivity training. You can be personally held responsible for a crime or for a breach of civil liability, and you can be sued in your personally because you acted outside the bounds of your government job, or changing the law so that it doesn't, so it can be, even if you're acting as a government official, you're still doing something that's against the law, right? And so, like, we need to tease out the reason why these rules are in place is to make sure that that governments can do their job without being weighed down by multiple civil suits, or that government actors can do their jobs, right? But the problem is that it also serves as a shield for bad actors.
One of the things
that helps.
It does help.
Thank you.
I want to get to Libby here on this. I just want to add one of the things, again, I prefaced all of this by saying there's so much that we don't know about this case. And what we've heard from the mother of Duante Wright, who was the man who was shot and killed, that he was apparently stopped for having air fresheners in the car, that enough that there is a law apparently in Minnesota that you can't have too many that are obstructing your view, and that apparently was the reason that he was pulled over. The question then becomes why, and another point is that as he was being pulled over, he called his mother because he wanted that kind of running soundtrack for her as someone else, even though his girlfriend was in the car, to have that going while he was interacting with police. What we don't know is why he exited the car, why someone, even if it was something like an air freshener, why he would be asked to get out of the car. And the questions being asked this morning, the question that is being asked, one of many, is did the police know about the warrants at that time or later? And that's a key question. Libby Post.
You know, if the police would routinely pull over people who have big phones up on their dashboard for their nav programs, right, that they don't have the in-dash ones, but they put their big phones up there, and those are mostly white people who, you know, they don't get pulled over. They don't get pulled over, and their view is obstructed. It's like, what excuse can we use to pull somebody over who's driving while black? That's really what this sounds like. It's mind-boggling that this continues to happen, given, and especially in Minnesota, given what's happening. What'll be interesting, to bring it back to New York, is that, you know, last April, the governor gave every municipality orders to reinvent their police departments. I know that there are some places like the city of Saratoga Springs where there was a 10-month work done by a large group of people, and then the city said, thanks, but no thanks. We're going to keep things basically the way they are. We'll make a few little tweaks, but we like things just the way they are. And, you know, that city is plagued with racial strife, which is seething underneath the veneer of Saratoga Springs. And so, let's see what happens in New York State, if any of these plans are really going to be implemented and any police departments ever really get reinvented. And again, I'm not saying defund the police. I'm not saying get rid of law enforcement. I'm saying get rid of the white supremacists in law enforcement, have better training for law enforcement, have them understand racial disparities in law enforcement, and for them to get out of their little cocoons of, I have the power and you don't.
We're talking about the most latest shooting in Minnesota that happened yesterday afternoon with protests overnight. We have many letters on the subject. I will get to as many as I can here. Tony writes, I've said this before and I'll repeat it now. Why are we not investing in the creation of more non-lethal weapons so a policeman does not have to use a gun to subdue a potential assailant? Meanwhile, William writes, it's revealing that none of the panel mentioned the issue of compliance, even though in nearly every one of these police shooting tragedies, as with the recent one in Minnesota, it began with the suspect resisting arrest. I don't know that we know that, but okay. Also, New York City cut $1 billion from...
That sure wasn't true with the Army lieutenant, right?
I mean,
he couldn't have done more. He kept showing his hands. He kept speaking reasonably to them, and they were quite arrogant with him. So I don't think we should assume that it's all one way.
Resisting arrest, right. Also, New York City cut...
Exactly. Sorry.
Sienna, go ahead.
Joe.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, what he did in that Virginia case is exactly what I would do. Is he drove to a lighted gas station because he did not feel safe pulling over on a dark street. I believe it was like a mile and a half, or it was a significant distance to get there. But he did drive slowly. He did not drive off fast. Like it was a chase situation to a lighted gas station where he felt safe. And that's the right thing to do. That is what they're telling people of color to do. They're saying, go to a lighted place, put your hazards on, put your hands out the window so they see you're not reaching for anything. And the fact that individuals of color have to do these things during a stop should be infuriating. You have to understand that when you have an interaction with law enforcement, it doesn't matter who you are. If you're a person of color, for the most part, it's a heightened situation because of what the atmosphere is. You automatically think that something may happen to you. And so I feel like individuals always give grace to the police officers, as they should, because they're putting themselves in a dangerous situation. But what about the person being pulled over? They are also in a heightened situation. They're also very scared. And so I think that also has to be taken into account when you're talking about these situations. People are scared. I feel like that's important to note.
Absolutely, absolutely. I do want to get to the second part of William's note, which says, also New York City cut $1 billion from its undercover crime unit and now got rid of qualified immunity for its officers. The effect is police will pull back, resulting in more black-on-black murders and higher crime rates on a city where crime has already skyrocketed in the past year. Anyone on that, and if that is true?
Well, first of all, we don't know. I don't think it is true. I think I know where the letter writer is coming from because of the nature of his letter. But I do think that qualified immunity lets people get away with it, lets cops get away with it. And that shouldn't be the case. It's that simple. And by the way, if you noticed in the Virginia case, am I wrong? Didn't they pepper spray him for no reason at all?
They did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's correct.
That's what I thought.
Right. What's
New York City Council did pass qualified immunity reform 2 weeks ago at the end of March. I actually noticed it on there's a write-up on the Cato Institute website, which is not necessarily known for being left-leaning. So maybe this individual wants to take a look at their assessment. But the myth of black-on-black crime being and the rates at which crime occurs broken down by demographic, proportionate to the percentage of population. It's a loaded term. Using that term means that typically the person hasn't taken the time to read the studies about ethnic breakdown and crimes, and certainly haven't read the studies between that and policing. This listener is putting a lot of complicated, nuanced issues together in sort of a more simplified framework that actually misses the reality of the situation, both in policing and what's accurate in terms of policing, and being black and living in a society that doesn't regulate policing the way that it should.
You know, you've been talking about this Virginia case, and I think it's worth noting that that actual stop happened in December, and it's taken this long before We've seen the video has been released, and we know more about what has happened, which just leads you to wonder, you know, how many of these are brewing and that we don't know about. But one of the police officers accused of using excessive force has been fired following an investigation. However, the other officer is still in service. And the reason that the Army officer was stopped was because he was missing plates on a brand new SUV.
But he had plates in the back window.
Correct.
It says brand new, but he did have plates. Yeah.
That is obviously another case, and now the town was at the end of their investigation, which is why we know about it now. Let's go back to letters and go to Ricky, who says, it seems to me that there is a cycle with these tragic killings of black people. Police kill an unarmed black person, unrest and violence breaks out as response. Right-wing big media puts the unrest and violence as lead story and focus their anger on Black Lives Matter. Also, this from Duncan, who says, simply cannot believe the news from Minneapolis today. Police shoot an unarmed individual because there's a warrant out for their arrest. Why shoot? Why use deadly force? While we don't know the details, unless this individual was posing a threat, there's absolutely no rationale. Police training is completely out of control and has become an indelible stain on police forces throughout this nation. We go to Erica, whose email has the subject line, I'm pissed off. Have we learned yet that when you give a racist a stage, all other racists think it's time to come out and cleanse the wound? Also, regardless of the details, I'd bet my life his warrant was not for a crime punishable by death. Since when did America decide citizens can execute people for all crimes at will? And then protesters react and the narrative becomes their reckless behavior. And we go to John, who says, how do we balance the fact that guns are rampant in the public? Every criminal and mentally ill individual has an AR-15 on their wall and potentially in their car. The police are rightly worried about being a militarized situation and being in one because everyone has military-grade weapons.
Well, statistically, it's the white men that they should then be targeting and afraid of.
Well said.
Everyone does not have such a gun.
No, not everyone has such a gun.
I don't have one.
No, but I think what Sarah is saying is the preponderance of these folks who have done the shooting with the AR-15s are angry white men.
Mm-hmm. I hear what she's saying. Yeah, yeah, sure.
That's the point. But I also think, you know, Erica's letter speaks to the incredible, well-honed art of playing the victim so that you create the situation and then you turn yourself into the victim to then bolster the reason for your actions.
So could you give us a specific on that one? For example, pause.
Well, she talked about, you know, Joe, can you read her letter again? Because it was two letters ago. Erica.
Yeah, okay. Give me a second.
Joe deposits a lot of these.
Yeah. I moved.
In the circular file.
I moved on.
I know, in the virtual circular file.
And yes, here we go. So would you want me to read? Have we learned yet that when you give a racist a stage, all other racists think it's time to come out and cleanse the world? Also, regardless of the details, I bet my life as Warren was not for a crime punishable by death. Since when did America decide citizens can execute people for all crimes at will? And then protesters react and the narrative becomes their reckless behavior.
That's
and
it.
You heard the cop. And you heard the cop who got fired. I believe that's the one who got fired, who's giving the guy in Virginia a hard time, say, you're going to ride the lightning. Did anybody else hear that one? You're going to ride the lightning?
And what were you saying, Libby?
Well, that's it. The last sentence there was the issue, is that, you know, they create this situation where people come out into the street and protest. And then those who create the situation can consider themselves the victims of the protests. They're very good at portraying themselves as the victims of a situation that they themselves perpetrated. We keep seeing it over and over and over again.
The second officer, who I believe is still on the force in the Virginia case, what Alan was responding to, the Joe Gutierrez responded, "What's going on is you're fixing to ride the lightning, son." And that was what he said at the time. And again, I should mention the reason that story has come out is now that the officer, the black army officer who was pulled over, is suing the police department. We go to Susan, who writes this on qualified immunity. "I am with Alan. We must wait and see what result New York City sees. At least they suspended police's current vast entitlement. Also, I feel that our words as we respond to this gut-wrenching news are too polite, too calm, too measured. We're witnessing horror visited upon citizens." And I don't disagree with Susan on that last point. I just think it's probably we're being careful until we know a little bit more than we know. Military personnel serving in the field, says Kimberly, are trained to shoot first and ask questions later. We need to do a much more thorough screening of police candidates. And while we're at it, let's return to training them as and calling them peace officers. That from Kimberly. Nan from Albany writes, "After George Floyd's murder, I started purposely taking a moment whenever I get into my car to think about how, if I were black, I should behave if pulled over by the police. It may seem silly, but it gives me a tiny sense of what black people go through every single day."
Yeah, and I'd love to hear from Sienna on this one, because there's something called the conversation, which, you know, I have a African American grandchild, and you know, I know that those kids have got to be told what to do when this inevitably will happen to them, and it will be inevitable.
It's very true. Like I've shared before, I have a 9-year-old son. And so sometimes he's getting kind of tall now. And to me, he's just a baby. But, you know, take your hood off. You know, I tell him all the time, we walk through the store, take your hood off. If he's going through, you know, through the aisle by himself and I'm in another aisle, you know, you want to make him look I don't want my son to look threatening at all. And that shouldn't be something that a young 9-year-old should have to think about. Right. And that's what we're fighting against and that's why it's so important, because you have these kids who have to shoulder responsibilities of an adult because of the police officers or whoever's law enforcement misconceptions or stereotypes about what they think is going to happen. You have these young kids having to shoulder that responsibility, and it's a lot for me, a 9-year-old, you know, but it's a conversation we have to have, and it's a heavy conversation. And, you know, they're not having these conversations in school. They're not having these conversations to everyone in his local Bethlehem school. They're not all saying that to all the kids. No, it's only my son that I have to have this conversation with him at home. How else to make a child feel, more pressure on him? Because he knows all his good friends, they don't have to deal with it.
We'll be back with more of the Roundtable Panel of the Week in Review after this.
Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Roundtable producer Sarah LaDuke.
For Thursday's show, Alan Chartok and Joe Donahue welcomed Edward Hamilton, Distinguished Professor of Computer Sciences at RPI and Faculty Associate at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University, Fran Berman, Assistant Dean in the College of Education and Human Services at Montclair State University, Carolina Gonzalez, and Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI and Director of the RPI-IBM Artificial Intelligence Research Collaboration, Jim Hendler.
The Democrats are looking to introduce legislation today. This will take place today to expand the Supreme Court of the United States of America. House and Senate Democrats will introduce legislation to expand the number of Supreme Court justices to 13 from 9, drawing more attention to the debate surrounding court reform. The bill, led by your friend, Alan, Ed Markey, Democrat of Massachusetts, and Representative Jerry Nadler of New York, is the first legislation in recent years designed to add seats to the high court, and its introduction comes as progressive organizations are pushing for court expansion after watching Senate Republicans fill 3 Supreme Court vacancies in 4 years under President Donald Trump. President Joe Biden, however, has said he is, quote, not a fan of the idea, also known as court packing. Instead, the White House announced last week the creation of a bipartisan commission to study reforms to the Supreme Court and produce a report. The High Court currently has a 6-3 conservative majority. Alan, as I said at the very beginning, we've discussed this on the periphery for a long time, but now it is at our doorstep. So what do you make of it?
Well, first of all, it ain't going to happen. You can write it down. Because the Republicans, who all live in the land of no, will vote no very quickly. So now you got 50 votes on no. You've got a number of senators who have said that looked askance at it. You have the leader of the party, Joe Biden, who is saying basically no. But what it does do, I think there is a positive effect from it. What it does do is it puts the court on notice. You better watch yourselves. Because if you don't, if it's all Republicanism all the time and you come down Citizens United and all of those terrible decisions that they've been making, then maybe we'll go back to it. But my bet is that that's not going to happen.
Carolina, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think that this was a constant question that obviously we know President Biden was posed with during his campaign trail and tried to avoid it and semi not answer it, quite honestly. And I think only when he gave a I'm not a fan of it response was when the media backed off. I think that the commission is a good indication of him trying to explore what possibilities are there. Although, like Alan mentioned, I don't think it will happen. I do think, though, that the Democrats' introduction of this bill speaks loudly and says or states that they don't want to wait for a commission to conduct its analysis or to come with recommendations, and they want to try and change things sooner if they can, and at least just put people on notice, as Alan mentioned as well.
Fran Berman.
Yeah, I think this is pretty interesting. Sadly, I think Alan's right that it probably, as a bill isn't going to work. But here's some stuff that I learned when I was kind of poking around looking at this. This is not a new idea. The Federal Judiciary Act of 1789 kicked it all off with 6 justices. So originally we had 6 justices. That changed like 6 times between then and now. You know, we had 6, then we had 5, then we had 7, then we had 9. You know, and it's kind of jumped around for various purposes, sometimes political for sure. So, you know, it's sort of interesting that that's just not a hard and fast number. I do think that if it's a non-starter, which, you know, it probably is, this commission will be a really interesting thing. So so Biden wants this commission to study, Supreme Court reform instead. And, you know, there's other things that could be done. For example, there's no age limit on Supreme Court justices. But imagine that put some sort of limitation on, you know, who could serve for how long and when. So they're, you know, not a lawyer, to be sure, but there's probably some interesting things to be explored. And, you know, I do think it's kind of an interesting direction.
Jim Handler.
Yeah, you know, I think there's, I too agree with Alan that it's not likely to pass anytime soon, but I think it also has another purpose because it sends a message to this court. Recently, there have been some fairly minor but impactful decisions by the current court, very conservative decisions, and they're not the big issues that are looming, but we can see Roe versus Wade coming, we can see some other things. And there's this very strong move from the right wing to ask the court not just to make narrow rulings in those, but very large rulings. So, for example, in the abortion case, Roe versus Wade, the talk up until recently has been, will they overturn it? Meaning the states will get to make their own decisions. Now it looks like there's going to be a push to actually get them to outlaw it, using some weird reading of the 14th Amendment and things like that. And I think the Congress is really sending a message with this that says, if you go too far, we can change this.
Exactly. They put them on notice and they say, you do this. And I think that they're going to be watching themselves. And I think that's an effective strategy, don't you, Jim?
You know, there's not a lot of other strategies to use, Alan. I think so. Absolutely. There's been a move to do that, to put this into legislation for a while now. I think the fact that there were these recent rulings, which is almost immediately followed by this being put on the docket, really is makes it a very clear message.
And the context, of course, is the denial of Obama being allowed to put his attorney general, then a candidate for the court, on the court. So I think the American people got the idea that Trump, in addition to lying and lying and lying, was also a guy who did some terrible things, and one of them was with the court.
Alan, there's been some pressure that I heard on Breyer to retire before the midterms. What do you think about that?
I love vanilla ice cream. No.
With sprinkles?
There are a lot of people. You have to be older to get that. Because I remember when Uncle Joe came over with cherry vanilla and he says, this is a new flavor. So that's how old. So I can just say, you're right. I think that the pressure will be great. And we'll see whether or not it achieves the results. I think Roberts is the most interesting guy on the court now, because more and more he's siding with the progressives or the liberals on the court, and that is fascinating to me because he knows the truth. He's doing what judges are supposed to do, the cult of the robe. You put on the robe and you can't be fired, and that's why we say you can't be fired.
Alan Chartok on the Roundtable panel on Thursday, April 15th. Please note as you listen, any given topic's details and facts may have changed and evolved since the panels took place live earlier in the week. We'll be back with more Roundtable Panel The Week in Review after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. Later on Thursday's show, Joe Donahue and Alan Chartok spoke with Dr. Jim Fagan.
I know Alan's got questions for you. I've got questions for you. I guess the place to start, though, is how much this Johnson & Johnson pause screws things up.
Well, it does obviously cause some problems, but, you know, I think it's very important that the CDC and the FDA exercise an abundance of caution when dealing with a novel vaccine. I think, you know, we always have to remember that the learning curve in medicine has no endpoint. And, you know, that being said, if you look at, you know, the incidence of, you know, what they're dealing with, the concern obviously is this blood clotting that occurred. There were six women who developed this cerebral venous sinus thrombosis, which in and of itself is extremely rare. I think the incidence of that is, you know, 5 cases per million people per year. So there were 6 women who developed this condition. And what's even more concerning is the fact that not only did they develop these blood clots in the brain, but all 6 women also had an associated what we call thrombocytopenia, which means that their platelet count was very, very low. And so what we need to do is understand, you know, what is that association? That's extremely rare to have low blood platelets and thrombosis and clotting. Usually the blood clots are caused by the platelets that clump. You're more likely to have a blood clot if your platelet count is high rather than low. And so I think that this obviously needs to be very carefully investigated to see if, in fact, this is related to the vaccine. It may not be related to the vaccine at all. I mean, again, there are 6 women. If you look at the demographics, there, all 6 women were white. Only one was taking hormonal contraceptive. The reason I bring that up is taking hormonal contraceptives can be associated with an increase in clotting. And all 6 women, as I said, had this low platelet count. And it's exceptionally rare, especially in healthy young individuals. And so there's some concern there. What is the impact of temporarily pausing the Johnson & Johnson vaccine? Well, it's fairly large. I mean, especially in certain populations. It's great that the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is, it's a one-shot vaccine. It makes it much easier to administer to, certain populations, people who would find it difficult to return for the second shot. So I think it's a real blow now. I mean, a pause of a couple of weeks, I don't think is going to set us back that much. But certainly it's something that I wouldn't take lightly.
Alan?
Well, when you say you wouldn't take it lightly, fortunately, I know you and I know your family. Would you tell your family, Jim Fagan, to stay away from it if they came to you and said, "Pop, want to take the Johnson & Johnson? It's easier to get to. They can give it to me." Intuitively, and this is what we call an honesty question, obviously.
Yeah.
What would you do?
The answer is yes. I would say they should take it, and the reason I say that is because first of all, remember, there were 7.5 million doses of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine that have already been administered.
The Johnson & Johnson vaccine
has proven to be very, very effective in preventing moderate to severe disease, death, and hospitalization and death. So we know that. We also know, Alan, that the incidence of clots and strokes is much higher with the COVID-19 disease than it is with any of the vaccines, including the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. So, if I had my choice right now, you could take Moderna, Pfizer, or Johnson & Johnson. Obviously, I would say, well, take Moderna, Johnson, or Pfizer. But if the choice was you can get vaccinated now, or you might have to wait, we're not sure exactly when you would be able to get vaccinated with Moderna or Pfizer, but you can get vaccinated with Johnson & Johnson right now, to someone who is otherwise healthy, I would say take the vaccine.
So I have, and the next question, and it's only because, even though I had my share of statistics and college and graduate school. Okay, so now you look at that same 7 to 6 million population. Couldn't you pick out some other things that people had, like heart attacks or, you know, numbers of people? What can we expect the next big blow to be?
Well, but that's an excellent point, Alan, and that's why they have to really look at this very, very carefully to determine, was this truly related to the vaccine or was this just a coincidental finding? Again, if 5 out of every million people per year develop cerebral venous sinus thrombosis, then having 6 women develop it is not that unusual. Now, what makes it unusual is, you know, these were 6 young women. They were between the ages of 18 and 48, so they were young. I don't know their medical histories, but what I understand is that they were fairly healthy. The thing that bothers me the most is what I mentioned before, is thrombocytopenia, the fact that they all had low platelets. Now, that would suggest the possibility that maybe this is an immune response to the vaccine, where they're developing, because of the vaccine, for some reason that we don't understand, antibodies or some sort of immune response against platelets, which would result in the thrombocytopenia, the low platelet count, and how that sort of ties in with the cerebral, you know, venous sinus thrombosis, I don't know. And the other thing is, you know, having blood clots in the brain like that is fairly, you know, it's unusual in the cerebral venous sinus area. You know, blood clots usually form in the legs, and they can travel up and cause pulmonary embolisms and get up into the brain and cause severe, you know, strokes and things like that. But having these clots in that particular area of the brain and also associated with the thrombocytopenia is what concerns me. And so we need to sort of figure this out. But you're right. I mean, if you look at, you know, heart attacks or other, you know, a whole variety of other illnesses, which, you know, we are all prone to, you know, it's very easy to sort of confuse that and associate it with the vaccine. So that's what, you know, they have to look. They have to look at the statistics and say, well, what, you know, is it likely that this is due to the vaccine? And again, the thrombocytopenia, that definitely bothers me. I mean, that you know, 6 women with, you know, that kind of blood clotting and that condition, and it all occurred within a few weeks after, you know, after the vaccine. And that's why I think they're right to pause Johnson & Johnson and really, you know, take a look at this. I mean, they may discover that these women, what they may discover is that there may be individuals who have a genetic susceptibility to develop a problem, you know, with, you know, this vaccine. And that's a broad concept, because I think that holds true for almost everything. You know, I think that there probably is a genetic susceptibility to adverse reactions to almost everything. You know, even if you look at the COVID-19 infection itself, we know that the vast majority of people with COVID-19, 99% of people who contract COVID-19 have a mild case. But there's those individuals who have moderate to severe disease, end up in the hospital, end up in the ICU, end up on a ventilator, and die. And we know, I mean, you know, to date there's been, you know, over 560,000 people who have died of this infection in the United States. And the question would be, well, how come? What's different about those people than those 99% who get the infection and don't have any problems with it? And I think that's where we're going to find genetic variants. When I say genetic variants, I'm not talking about in the SARS-CoV-2 virus. I'm talking about in us humans, you know, that establish immune responses. And so what I'm saying is that it may turn out that there are people who have genetic mutations that render them susceptible to adverse reactions, both to an infectious disease like COVID-19, and as well as to a vaccination. And it's possible that certain individuals, when they get vaccinated, it stimulates, you know, an immune response, an aberrant immune response that may be responsible for the symptoms that these 6 women had.
So let me ask this question. which I think is, you know, is probably one of the elephants in the room, which is we had a lot of concern about vaccine hesitancy. So with many people, and yes, this is anecdotal, but even people who respond to polling say one of the reasons they wouldn't get the vaccine is because they feel that it hasn't been tested properly. It came on the market too quickly, not just Johnson & Johnson, but vaccines in general. So what do we do to counter that at this point, even for you as a physician, as Alan noted, asking about, you know, for your family, but for your patients and in general, of how we navigate these choppy waters with people who are reluctant to get vaccinated?
Yeah, I would first say that the clinical trials that Pfizer, Moderna, Johnson & Johnson, that they laid out and that they performed were the same clinical trials that, you know, you would do for any new vaccine. No corners were cut in dealing with this. What made the vaccine production so fast was that they were able to get so many people who were willing to participate in the clinical trials because of the pandemic, that a lot of people signed up, you know, for these clinical trials. There were, I think, 44,000 in the Pfizer trial, 30,000 in the Moderna trial. So, and so they were able, but they weren't cutting corners in terms of what is normally done to develop a new vaccine. And you know, a lot of attention was paid on efficacy, on safety issues, and the results confirmed that these vaccines are very effective and, quite honestly, are very, very, very safe. You know, even given what, you know, this new recent thing with these six women, they're still, look at the 7.5 million people who received the Johnson & Johnson vaccine who are now completely immunized against COVID-19 and had no problems with it.
Many questions from our audience about vaccines and so forth. So we go to Karen. In statistics like this, where six people were found to have developed blood clots, are there always some other people who have had some level of blood clot or low platelet count that was not severe enough to be noticed and so would not have come to the fore as effects to be documented?
The answer is absolutely yes. You know, because we don't generally do blood counts on individuals post-vaccination, and we're certainly not doing imaging studies like MRIs or, you know, CAT scans and things like that that would have to be done. You know, if someone is completely asymptomatic, you know, what, you know, in asymptomatic in terms of not having any headaches or blurred vision or seizures or anything that would obviously suggest the possibility of a cerebral blood clot or stroke, and they're completely asymptomatic, is it? I guess the question is it still possible that some of these people might be experiencing some mild side effects of the vaccine? And the answer is yes. But if they don't develop any symptoms and they're fine, you know, for weeks and months after that, then you know, big deal, I would say. But yeah, you know, again, I think that the answer to that question is yes. It certainly is possible that more than six people, you know, had issues with this vaccine, and we may never know about that. But, you know, as long as they don't develop any significant illness, then I am comfortable with it.
Steve writes, are side effects or a lack thereof an indication of how well the vaccine protects an individual?
Yeah, you know, I always tell patients when they get side effects, and typical side effects from the vaccine are, you know, fever, aches and pains, sore arm, you know, fatigue, those kinds of things. And, you know, I often get calls from, you know, from parents of kids who are experiencing that. And I, you know, tell them, well, that's a good thing because it means that the vaccine is working. It's not a bad thing if they don't have those symptoms. That doesn't mean the vaccine was not working. But reactions that you get to a vaccine, which is sort of a turning on of the immune system, will occur usually, you know, on day one, day two after the vaccine, may last for a couple of days. The problems that these six women had, those problems occurred a couple of weeks, I think it was 2 to 3 weeks, after they received the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. That's a whole different story.
You said kids. You don't. I thought kids couldn't have it yet. But
no, when I'm saying kids, I mean other vaccines like the, you know, the measles.
Oh, I see. I got it.
Like
I got it.
Yeah, the kids are not getting. Kids probably, they're working on the 12 to 16 age group, and that probably will be available by the summer.
Yeah, and I was going to ask about that. I'm glad Alan brought it up because that, I mean, that's important too. And talk about, you know, what that will allow us, sort of the end game there of bringing kids into the mix of getting vaccinated.
Well, the end game is primarily, you know, school and,
right.
and getting everybody back to in-person learning, which I think is critically important. We know that, you know, most kids do fairly well, you know, with COVID-19, although there is this, you know, multi-inflammatory syndrome in children that, you know, it's been reported that we're concerned about. But, you know, the problem with kids, you know, getting COVID-19 is that they transmit it to their parents and their grandparents and adults, some of whom may have conditions that, you know, place them at high risk for COVID-19. And so having kids vaccinated is certainly going to be another, you know, it's going to certainly ease our mind in terms of the transmission of this infection. And I can't wait till we get the kids, you know, 6 to 12 as well, which will probably not be until the end of the year. But, you know, I think that vaccinating kids 12 and older, you know, will certainly be a very good thing to do.
I want to go back real quick to the what we were talking about, some of the issues, and you touched on this, so I just want to clarify a little bit more. But are we looking at so I don't really know what I'm talking about here, so bear with me. But my understanding was that one of the reasons that the vaccine, that the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, that it was different properties. It was a different type of medicine, that Moderna and Pfizer were similar in their makeup, whereas Johnson & Johnson was different. Am I right on
correct.
That so far? Okay.
Absolutely correct.
So is the same. So my question is the same apply for AstraZeneca? And then if so, what does that tell us about things that veer away from the Pfizer-Moderna model?
Yeah. And no, it's a very good question, Joe, because the AstraZeneca vaccine, by the way, had similar problems with clotting. You know, it wasn't just the Johnson & Johnson. And what's the connection? The Moderna and Pfizer vaccines are messenger RNA vaccines. The AstraZeneca and the Johnson & Johnson vaccine are viral vector vaccines. What a viral vector vaccine means that you take in this case, the RNA of the SARS-CoV-2 virus, and you incorporate it into the DNA of the virus. The virus that both Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca use is an adenovirus. The AstraZeneca uses a monkey adenovirus, whereas the Johnson & Johnson uses a human adenovirus. But they're very, very similar. So the Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca are very, very similar to each other, just the way that the Moderna and Pfizer are very similar to each other. But the Moderna-Pfizer are very different than the Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca. So you're absolutely correct. Completely different type of vaccine.
Dr. Jim Fagan on the Roundtable panel on Thursday, April 15th. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable. You may contact us by emailing roundtable@wamc.org. This has been this week's Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. Thank you for listening.